Okay. So, like I said, I want to go ahead and introduce the numbers now, because we're going to start encountering them more frequently, especially the ones that people are curious about, 666, 144,000. And I can explain those sort of generally, what's happening in that in those texts. Those two are sort of fighting each other, at least in the form of worship. But I would like just to give you some insight into what John is doing. So I'll come back to and finish up what we were working on last week, where we got to the place of the two witnesses. But that place is an interlude, right? We've had seals and we've had trumpets, and we get sort of a story that doesn't exactly fit in with the trumpets per se. So I'm going to give my own interlude to the way I'd originally planned things. Just quickly before I get into it, though, I was listening to a podcast this week. But have you guys heard of The Bible Project? The Bible Project is a really wonderful resource that's being done by a few people, I think, who are associated with Western Seminary in Portland. And they have videos, I think, on every book of the Bible, plus also theological themes like the kingdom of God, the Messiah, those sorts of things. And I've used it in teaching before, because they do such a great job of summarizing large blocks of material in, you know, somewhere between 6 and 12 minutes. So I can write that up. It's called The Bible Project. Let me push this out real quick. But if you're ever wondering, if you have questions, like I said, I didn't realize they did a podcast as well. And so right now what I'm looking at is a six-part series on the Day of the Lord. But anyway, if you get a chance, it's called The Bible Project. And you can find their videos on YouTube really easily. I think it's just a wonderful resource to have. But the reason why I bring this up is, one, to give you a resource, but secondly, because they start talking about the Day of the Lord in this lecture, or in this series, and I think it's really helpful for what we're talking about. The idea of the Day of the Lord, we tend to think of it in terms of, well, maybe we don't have really categories for thinking about it, because we don't use that expression very often. But it has usually been associated with the end times. And so these... It's two guys who are talking about it. In the Old Testament, that's not the way the Day of the Lord is understood, at least not in certain contexts. So the first time it shows up is in the book of Amos, because he's considered one of the oldest prophets. There's a few things that we have to do. One is we have to sort of recapture Palestinian way of thinking, an old Palestinian way of thinking about history, which is that history is not a straight line. It's more of a sort of a cycle, like we're talking about in Revelation, a series of repeated events. And so, for example, when Isaiah talks about the Day of the Lord, there's this wonderful poem in Isaiah, I'm forgetting the chapter now, but he keeps talking about the Day of the Lord, and a lot of people will take this to mean he's talking about the last days, but he makes it very clear that he is talking about the downfall of Assyria. So God bringing his justice and saving his people, okay? And so they give the example, like, as this theme develops, we see it in the New Testament as well, in 2 Thessalonians, and the idea is in Revelation, because John is drawing on the prophets, that they use the example in this podcast. That they say, if you look out east from Portland, and you see Mount Hood, but also the foothills along it, that for these prophets... each of those little sort of peaks of these foothills is sort of like an encounter with the Day of the Lord. You're having something major happen, the downfall of Babylon, the downfall of the Macedonian Empire, the downfall of the Greek states, the downfall of... In these encounters with these enemies of God, that his people are saved. But they're ultimately looking towards, whether they realize it or not, Mount Hood, or the real, or the end time sort of Day of the Lord, that final sort of encounter. And so you get to view it, each of these sort of foothills from the next one, and see how the Day of the Lord has been encountered in each of these sort of series. So I think that's helpful for understanding what's happening in Revelation as well, that John is in a certain way talking about Rome. And that's very clear, as we'll see today. But he's not just talking about Rome, and he realizes that. And I think that's why he purposefully chooses words like Babylon instead of saying Rome. Some people, like I've said, try and say that he's trying to hide what he's talking about. John is not trying to hide what he's talking about. John is speaking prophetically within the tradition of the prophets, but aware that given the resurrection of Jesus Christ and that Christ promises the end of all things, that he's looking forward to that, but also this ongoing sort of engagement of the kingdom of God with 666 in that empire. Okay, so Revelation and Numbers, and I'll come back to this other stuff next week, talking about the two witnesses and the end of the trumpets and the bowls of wrath. Okay. Usually, when you hear things like, what I'm going to deal with mostly probably is 666, because that's what most people are interested in, but I'll talk about the other aspects as well. What sort of numbers do we see in Revelation? I'll just write them up here on the board. Seven. Why is seven important? Seven doesn't really fit into our scheme of first century mathematics, but it's important still. Why is it important? Completeness. Perfection. What's it associated with in Jewish tradition? So the seven churches, yeah. What about in Judaism? Creation. Yeah. So completeness in the sense of God finished his work. Not that he quit working. He didn't go and have a coffee break and say, you guys take care of yourselves. But the work of creating is done. Okay? What other numbers? 666. You can't have that one. That's mine. Okay, and 144,000. Now, can you... Yeah, four. Right, we talked about that as well. Yeah, that is a square number, but it's also important because it relates to these references to the types or to the peoples. Anything else? Yeah, and 12 isn't exactly fitting into our mathematical scheme, but why is that important from a Jewish perspective? 12 tribes, good. So that'll be important. And John will use that in a square number or squarish number when he does 144,000. Anything else? 10. How does he use 10? Oh, 10 commandments, yeah. Okay. I can't think of John using it in Revelation. I'm going to put it, now you got me confused. Maybe it is in there. I'm going to put it right there, just in case. Anything else? All right. We'll come back to it. There's a few other ones that we'll see as they pop up and how they fit into this. Yes, the numbers are base 10. I don't think they thought in those terms, but that's okay. We'll come back to it. Usually when people talk about what is 666, what do they do, especially nowadays? How do they interpret that? The devil, evil, or they pick a political figure, right? Usually it's a president. I mean, every single president, as long as I can remember, has been said is the representation of this beast. Reagan... George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, I'm sure Trump as well. It doesn't matter. Somebody will come up and say, look. Right? And this is how it usually works. Let me show you because... okay. There we go. Here's how it usually works. And rather than pick a political figure, I just use myself because I don't want to betray any sort of political bias or create a sort of fight. Oh, here's my name. And the way it usually works, right, is each letter is assigned a numerical value, okay? And that makes sense because that is, in fact, what the first century church would have understood or done, okay? So like this, right? A's are worth 1, N's are worth 20, D's are worth 5, and so on. Guess what, folks? That adds up to 666. Okay? I can do this with pretty much any name. Okay, now you may say, yeah, but your middle name is Rhett, so how do you figure that into it? Well, I would just recalculate. Like I said, I can do this with anyone if just take enough time to think about it. The question is, would this have made sense to the first century church to think in this way of making up numbers and or letters and their values? Would that have made sense? And the answer is just no, it wouldn't have made sense to them. Let's see, what's next? Let's do this. Not that. Okay. Much of the world used letters for counting until 1200 AD. Okay. So, for example, in Latin you have IVX LCM, right? and you know these are numerical values. The same with Greek and Hebrew. Okay, it's not until we get Arabic numerals that are separate. So, for example, what is CXVI? Yeah, 116. Good. Okay. The same is for Greek, right? And these values are set. The Romans didn't say, you know what? Sometimes I want C to equal 56, maybe 72, right? That would be artificial. That would be made up, and nobody would understand. Like, if you're having an exchange in a market and saying, I'd like C chickens or something like that. You know, my Latin's not very good, but say that they wouldn't give you 52 chickens. They would understand that there's a set value based on that letter, and that wouldn't be a problem. So, having said that, there is already in the Roman world, in the Greco-Roman world, and the Hebrew world, because the same thing happens from the Assyrian times, this connection between words and numbers. So they would look for, you know, significance based on the value of your name, because there would be a natural value to your name, numerical value, not moral value necessarily. Anyway, the terms for this thing is expressed in two different ways. In Hebrew, it's usually called gematria, which means there's a numerical value of words that have some significance. Okay. In the Greek tradition, we refer to it as isosephi, which is a riddle that puts two words near each other that have the same numerical value, and you, as the reader, are supposed to figure it out. Okay. And this happens a lot. I've got some examples. I'll show you some examples, okay? But these are the two words that I may keep referring back to. Sometimes we say numerology, but numerology can also have a bit more of an astrological idea behind it, and that's not necessarily what's happening here. Also, just to be clear, John is not saying necessarily that there's this magical connection between the words and the numbers. I think in a way he's pointing to a providential significance. Look at what's happened here. Okay, so for example, we have graffiti from Pompeii where a guy says, I love her whose number is 545. It's a really sad, romantic bit of graffiti, right? Because we all know that Pompeii was covered during the eruption of Vesuvius. But this woman would likely have known, that's me. Who wrote this, right? Who did this? The Epistle of Barnabas, it's a letter from the first century, and he tries to explain the number 318 in Genesis 14:14, and he tries to do some sort of numerological significance based on that. Even Augustine, right? So this is already to the 5th century. The people are still doing the same sort of thing with numerical value of letters and names. And he tells them, he says, count up, keep counting. You add these two together. And then in the end, he says, you know what, just do it at home, okay? We don't have time to do this here. And then there's questions here, right? There's four Gospels, and I talked about the significance of four, all nations, peoples, tribes, language, and so on and so forth. That, in fact, this was an early church argument for why there should only be four Gospels and why things that, when people brought in these other, tried to bring in other Gospels later in the second and third century, they said, well, they offered this theological argument saying, well, in addition to the fact that none of the apostles wrote those, we already have the four Gospels, and that's complete, okay? 14 letters of Paul because Hebrews was included. Paul quotes 7 Old Testament texts in Romans to show that Jews and Gentiles are under sin, the completeness, that sort of language. So there's all sorts of questions, or examples, rather, of how numbers are significant in the New Testament and outside of it. And so John is drawing on something that first century people would have understood. They wouldn't have gotten to 666 and said, what on earth are you doing, John? Why? Because you'll see in your sheet in just a minute. John is drawing on a very strong, very old Greek and Hebrew tradition of this numerical values of letters. And the person that this is most immediately attributed to is a famous person that you will all recognize, likely if you remember your math, and that is Pythagoras. You guys know Pythagoras? What do you know about Pythagoras? Pythagorean theorem. What is it? Right? It's grounded to your memory forever. Right? You will never forget that. A squared plus b squared equals c squared, right, if you want to find the area of a triangle, right? Okay. Or at least find the sides, okay? He's known for that, but that's not it. Pythagoras basically made, he essentially made a religion out of numbers. And in a certain extent, Plato followed him, right? Because there are certain things in the world that we can talk about, like we talk about a human nature or an animal nature or the nature of a tree. What is a tree supposed to be or what is a person supposed to be, right? And so when I try and figure out what the human nature is, I can take any one of you and think about what is it that we share together, and that's the human nature. So you aren't actually a human nature, but you share in it. Everybody in here does. Now, for Plato and Pythagoras, numbers were different because, right, if I show you three fingers, what about that? How do you get the three out of it? And how do we set it aside and look at it separately? So these things are closer to what they would call something like an ideal. And so Plato essentially comes to the point of taking numbers as the most important, or not the most important, but things essentially almost worthy of veneration and close to worship. And Pythagoras was his predecessor in this regard. Okay, what else did he do? He talked about certain types of numbers that then become important to the Greco-Roman world because they have a certain significance. He talked about, there you go, a little cartoon for you. He talked about certain types of numbers. He talked about numbers that could be represented in shapes. Numbers that when they're multiplied out, they form a certain shape like what he called triangular numbers. Square numbers, you all know square numbers, and rectangular numbers, right? And people, this would be, for your mathematics, you would have memorized, it's like the multiplication table. What's 8 times 7? Yeah, okay. What's 6 times 2? Okay, so that's something that when you were a child, that you just were drilled on that. This same sort of thing would have happened for people in the first century who were doing mathematics. Okay, what else is significant about this is that we have a Pythagorean tradition, or at least religion, that's based in Smyrna. So we have this Theon of Smyrna is a significant student, or at least Pythagorean. And then a very significant Jewish scholar called Philo of Alexandria, who came just before the time of Jesus, who also talks about these types of numbers. Okay, so my point is just to say this is not something that's obscure or strange to the first century. This is just something that is part of the culture that they understand. Okay, Revelation meant something to the first century church. They were not baffled in saying, well, maybe 2017 years from now, people will figure out what's going on. Okay? All right, so on your sheets there, you have, there we go, what are they called? The series numbers and then the values of those things. So for the first triangle, it's worth 1. The second triangle is worth 3, right? The third triangular number is 6, and so on. And the same works for these. And I'll show you how it works out, right? Representing number shapes. Usually they would use stones, set out a stone to help you count it out to make sure that you had done your work correctly. Okay, so our first triangular number is 1. I put it as a circle. I should have probably done triangles instead of circles. Now that I have done this already, I realize that. But if you want to get to your second triangle, how many do you have to add to this? 2, right. And if you want to get to your third triangular number, 3. Right. So you add 3, and then you have a total for your third triangular number. Its value is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay? Does that make sense? Good. If you need the formula, by the way, it's this. Triangle equals the number times the number plus 1 divided by 2. Not that it's all that important. You guys aren't going to... You should write this on checks, right? Anyway. So that's triangular numbers, okay? All these types of number shapes are important in the book of Revelation. That's why I'm going to go through all of them. So that's triangular numbers. You guys know square numbers. It's not a terribly difficult one. I did it with circles again. I should have done it with squares. But, it's too late now. So, for square numbers, it's easier to remember, right? Because we learn the squares of numbers when we do our basic multiplication tables anyway. So, first square is 1. The second square is 4. The third square, did I do a third square? Yeah. Third square is 9. Okay? But you see how these are represented in the shapes as well. We don't tend to think in number shapes. And again, this is fun for the first century, figuring out these sorts of things. They didn't have television or iPads. Books were hard to come by because if you had a book, it was really expensive for you to have gotten it. Okay, and literacy rate was pretty low, below 30%. And so you'd have one person basically who could read to a community. Okay, does that make sense so far? Questions? You already know how to do square numbers. I don't need to tell you. Yeah. I'll show you how this has to do with the values of letters, because each of the letters in the Greek alphabet and the Roman alphabet and the Hebrew alphabet are assigned a value that is not made up in Revelation, but it has a history all before this. So like I said, if you were in Israel and you were making a purchase and you said you wanted Aleph, loaves of bread, then they would give you that value of bread. They wouldn't say, oh, I don't even know what you're talking about. You're a crazy person. Because the number, the values of the letters were set. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what alphabet is 616?
Hey, 616. How did you know about that one? Okay. We'll come to it, okay? Because that's really important for this as well. I wasn't going to talk about it, but I will now. Hooray. Okay. Let's see. Why do you keep shutting down on me? Rectangular numbers. The first rectangle is 2. I don't know why, but it is. There it is. Second rectangular is 6, and so on. And the rectangular formula, I think, is there. The number, so the second rectangle times the number plus 1. That's how you make rectangular numbers. Okay, and so the next one you would add 3, 5 onto it, right? Yeah. No, 6 onto it. But that's the first rectangle. Second rectangle is 6. Third rectangle is 3, 6. Yeah. 18? 12. Okay. Now, I think I also put on there numerical values, or values of, yeah, the values of the letters. So the Hebrew, in Hebrew gematria, those number and letter values are set. Okay, those are not, like I said, that doesn't change. Okay, so here's your whole chart. Okay, so if I was to ask you, what is the 13th rectangle, what would you say? Rectangle, 182. Let me show you something that's interesting, at least to me. Yeah, okay. 666. 1,260, which is also in Revelation. Okay. 144. 42. All of these numbers show up in Revelation. All of them are either triangular, rectangular, or square, with the exception of significant Jewish numbers, like 12 and like 4. Oh, not 4. Sorry, 12 and 7. Not only that, this is an interesting triangular because 36 is also a triangle. So you've got a double triangle. Ooh. Right? So this is an especially significant number in Hebrew and Greek gematria. Okay? So a person reading this would be like, oh, this, like, you have to extra pay attention to this. And again, I keep saying how John is so perfectly placed providentially in history to draw on both his Greek and Jewish backgrounds that it's just incredible. So I gave you the Hebrew numerical values because John seems to be doing something called transliteration. He takes Greek words, and he puts them into Hebrew characters, and I'll show you how that works in just a moment. Here you go. The number of the beast, it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. I'm going to tell you, this is a puzzle that you're supposed to figure out, because just after this, look at this. 140 cubits by the counting of a man, which is the counting of an angel. So again, he like inverts the formula, but it's an invitation again to figure it out. You want to see why? Because the word for beast, transliterated in Hebrew, is 666. And the word for angel in Hebrew characters is 144. You can check. I know it. It's there on the sheet. But yes, these add up to 666 and 144. So you're invited. This one truly is a beast, and he had to be a beast because his value was 666, and that also means beast. Okay? Right, and we see them put together, right, that you have these two basically going against one another. Going against one another. Yeah. 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 Yes. Yeah. This would be by the time of the Assyrian Empire. So we're talking about 8th century BC. Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. Okay. Good question. So yeah, the idea of gematria, the idea of significance of number values of names, dates at least to the 8th century BC. But the number values are set even before that. Okay. Does that make sense? Good. Hooray. All right, next. Right, so he puts these two together in another place. Look, his number, 666. So the problem with where this is placed is it's right at a chapter break. And so, like I said, usually chapter breaks, we added those to make it easier to find things because it would be difficult for a person to say, we'll go to page 612, column 2, halfway down, and then a person would say, well, who is your scribe? Because my scribe writes very large, and your scribe writes very small. Right. So instead, we added in chapter numbers to make it easier to find things, but they also cause us to make mental breaks often. Right? We don't associate the chapter before with the chapter after. But you're supposed to connect these two. Right? These two are against each other somehow. This is bad, and this is good somehow. Okay. Now, there's more of these significant numbers. We see it in... Did I skip one? I skipped one. Right? 42 months, and I will grant authority to my witnesses. They will prophesy for 1,260 days. Okay. What's interesting is the way that he talks here is very similar to Daniel, but Daniel says 1,290 days. And so John seems to realize that this doesn't exactly fit in with his scheme, and so he wants it to better fit, and so he talks about it in 1,260 days. 42 months, or rather 1,260 days. Right, there you go. So compare with John or with Daniel, 1,211, 1,290 days. You know what else is really interesting, just as an aside, is that in Luke's gospel, the way that he structures the very opening infancy narrative is he is very careful to mention time, right? From Zechariah's being in the temple and losing his ability to speak, to how long Elizabeth is pregnant, to when Mary meets her when she is pregnant, to how long Mary is pregnant, and then the presentation of the child at the temple. If you add up all the time that he has done there, it adds up. And also that in Luke's gospel, he is drawing very strongly on the book of Daniel in the opening. And by the time you get to Jesus' presentation at the temple, it has been exactly 491 days, which matches with Daniel's reference to 70 weeks. So that Jesus is bringing in this eschatological age. He's the next day after the 70 weeks. And he is starting something new. That John is just hinting at it. But you have to pay attention. When something weird or sort of off or strange is said in the Bible, those are the times I think to pay attention the most. Say, why would you say that? Why would you say that sort of thing? My friend was teaching a class on the Gospel of Mark, and they're reading this passage, and he was inviting them to think through the passage. And there's this one point where he said, okay, we're at the feeding of the 5,000. What's happening here? And what do you notice? And one of the students said, well, he says he made them sit down in the green grass. And he said, okay, what's wrong with that? He said, well, everybody knows grass is green. Who cares? Why would you say he made them sit down in the green grass? And they pointed to the fact that Jesus has been referred to as the shepherd, that he's drawing on Psalm 23, right? And that here, Jesus is actually feeding his sheep. But you're making this sort of theological point with language that we may not necessarily pick up on. So, anyway, my point is just pay attention to the weird things. Revelation is harder because everything is weird. But in the Gospels, in the Old Testament, when there's a strange little bit of information, something extra you didn't need, then that's the time to pay attention. Right, 42 months, once again. Why am I mentioning all these? Because you'll see that there's a certain pattern that John uses in Revelation with these types of numbers. So, what is the pattern? Triangles generally are evil. That is to say, the only triangular number that shows up is 666. Square is good. The only time square numbers are mentioned are 144,000 that are associated particularly with good things. And the rectangular numbers are only referred to when we talk about time periods. Like I said, people think that John is just haphazardly sort of quoting whatever he has heard, but he is being very careful in the way that he is structured, and he talks about what he has seen and what he understands to be happening. Okay? So our rectangular numbers are 1,320 and 42. Wait, 1,260 and 42, rather. Okay. What's the next picture? Now, I said this because this sort of thing happens in other texts. In the Ascension of Isaiah text, not just about this, but there is a Nero-like Antichrist figure in the Ascension of Isaiah, which comes from the first or second century, and it says that he's going to rule for 1,332 days. Now, this person is using Greek isosephi, so they're not using Hebrew characters, they're using Greek characters. And if we go back to, or if you look at your chart, where does 1,332 show up? Yeah, the last one, the rectangular one. So he's not following the same exact pattern of John, but he's saying that, look, but he is using it for number reference, rather, or a time period reference. That's not always the case in all the letters, or all the books that we have. But again, he's trying to say, look, it's important. Okay, so why, having said all of that, bearing all of that in mind, why do I keep referencing Nero as being the beast? Supposed to give me a preview of what's coming next. This guy equals not just this, but particularly one head of the beast. There you go, Albrecht Dürer. Again, his odd paintings of the beast. These look like, it looks like a Muppet more, actually, than a beast there. But why does this matter, and how does this fit? How does Nero fit into this pattern, and how does 616 fit into the pattern as well? Why do I say he's 666? Because if you take the Greek, or the Hebrew transliteration of his name, Caesar Neron, that is Caesar Nero or Nero Caesar, his number adds up to 666. And you may say, ha ha, but that's artificial because his name is Nero. His name is not Caesar Nero. Well, unless the only way you ever see his name, ever, is Caesar Nero. Caesar Nero. That he's always displayed in this pattern, sometimes with Augustus as well. So why would people think, why would they associate it with him? Well, because people are already doing this, not just John, but other people are associating him with this negative imagery, but also putting together riddles about his name and calling him a beast. Okay, so this is thoroughly entrenched in the first century world. Why would the early church call him a beast? Well, because he was terrible for a number of reasons, most especially for persecuting Christians. And I'll put up some texts that talk about that. It's supposed to give me a preview, but it's not. Oh, I already did that. Boop. Ah, look at this. This is a riddle from the first century, I think, from the first century. Neopsephon neron idian metera apectena. And this means a new calculation. Nero killed his own mother. It's true. Nero did kill his own mother. Okay, that's why I put it up. It's not just some sort of fun riddle. That's a really sick riddle if it was. But you want to see something interesting about this. One, it's inviting you to calculate because that word calculate, psephon. Secondly, this is right behind. Nero, in Greek, Neron, adds up to 1,005. And killed his own mother adds up to 1,005. Right? So someone has spent the time to figure out how to make this riddle. They're like, how can we make this? How can we talk about? And the point is, like, look, he practically had to kill his own mother because his name adds up to kill your own mother. Right? So my point is just, this is already happening with Nero. This is not unique to John. John's way of talking about it is certainly unique. But the first century Roman world was divided on Nero. They either the average person seemed to really like him. In Rome, they seemed to really like him. Why? Well, because he threw amazing parties, festivals, games, feasts, horse races, and chariot races. They loved those sorts of things. But in the process, he bankrupted the empire. Okay, and so the nobility and the upper class and members of the Senate did not like him. And the worst thing he did was eventually he ended up turning his own Praetorian Guard, right? The secret service, the emperor's own protectors. They turned against him, and that was the end. As soon as you lose a Praetorian Guard as the emperor, you've got no hope. Okay. Here's the other thing. That word Seifan is from the word Seifidzo, which means I calculate. And it shows up in Revelation 13:18. It's an invitation. It's saying, figure out this riddle. Okay? It's not as though, again, this is not some sort of obscure, weird thing that John is doing. This is a common sort of invitation. Look, figure it out. You can do it. And for the first century church, and the way that John speaks, especially we'll see with reference to this beast that has a wound in its neck and then seems like it's been come back from the dead, we'll see why this matters in John's time and why they would have made the connection with Nero. Okay. Again, it's not just Nero. It's more than that. He could have just said, it's Nero. But the point here is that you will always have the empire rise up, a new emperor rise up, who will then lead you in a way that is ungodly idolatry that will take you away from the kingdom of God. Okay? That's the significance of this type of text, this type of genre. As a prophetic text, as an apocalyptic text, it is inviting you to continue to see the world through this lens, that the empire will always do this. And it will look, in certain ways, like it's beautiful, but it turns out that it's actually a prostitute drinking people's blood. Okay. Now, here, also from the Roman world, a text from Philostratus. I do not know either how many heads he has, and so on, or jagged teeth. And in any case, this beast is said to be civil, but he is not. He's wilder and fiercer than other animals. And again, there is no such beast anyhow of which you can say it devours its own mother, but Nero is gorged with such quarry. This sort of language about Nero is pretty common. This is 3rd century, I think. But it's, I mean, the things that happen after Nero dies, like I said, they recently discovered his palace. Was it 2011? It had been buried to erase his memory, essentially. Because after he burned Rome to the ground and blamed the Christians, and that's why the Christians were persecuted, he wanted this place that all these aristocrats had. So he burned down all their houses and then built a palace on top of it. And so their response was, here you go. I think this is the palace. I feel like this image is not correct, but I could be wrong. They buried it. They built on top of it. So Trajan's baths and toilets were put on top of it. And then part of an amphitheater just completely covered the place. He filled it with gold and ivory. So again, he has no sense of economic balance in any way. He just was over the top with everything. Because he also considered himself a god. He considered himself the actual embodiment of Apollo. And so he, along with Caligula, who was also terrible, insisted that they be regarded as Augustus in the truest sense, which is a divine being. After him, that we have the year of four emperors because it was so chaotic. We have, people like Otho, I forget, it doesn't matter. The names don't matter. What matters is someone finally saved it in the end, and that was Vespasian. So we have the end of this dynasty under the Flavian dynasty under Nero, and then a beginning of an entirely new dynasty. Vespasian was a general. He seemed to know how to, well, he just had a better head on his shoulders in terms of political balance and so on, and he rescued the empire from complete destruction. And so that makes sense of the way that John talks about. It looks like it was going to be destroyed, but you've got these beasts has got lots of heads, not just one head. Now, okay, this is what's really interesting. And again, why Nero and John, this perfect placing historically, especially with the image of who Christ is and what he has done. Oh, 616. 616. Sorry, let me come back to this. 616. Why did you say 616? Because in our oldest manuscripts of Revelation, the text reads 666, okay? But we have two manuscripts that read 616 instead. And it seems the only thing that really makes sense of it is that the person who is reading this text knows that it is Nero and is wondering why John has made it add up to 666, because this would be... How are you guys on your foreign languages? This, I believe, is the accusative form of his name. It would add up to 666. And this would be the nominative form of his name. right? So you drop off the last noon, I think, and or not noon. I'm forgetting my Hebrew. Final noon is 600. Noon is 50. Yes. So he drops off 50. He drops off Neron, that last inn, instead just has Nero. And that ups to 616 instead. So this person knew it was Nero, but didn't understand that John was using triangular numbers. Does that make sense? It's the only, like, it's great because it makes sense of both of these. So this would be Nero. This would be Nero. Right in English. Neron. Okay? Because that's how it shows up on the coins, and that's, that would be Caesar Nero. Yeah. So that's further evidence that this person is talking about, that John is referring to Nero as a good example of an Antichrist-like figure. Why do I say Antichrist-like figure? That's a really good question, by the way. I wasn't going to talk about it, but you brought it up, so good. Is that one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, right? This happens in Revelation 13. And then it says that wound, the head was wounded by the sword, and yet it lived. Do you guys know how Nero died? Right, he asked his friend to kill him, and his friend wouldn't do it, and so he took a Machaira, a short sword, and stabbed himself in the neck. Right, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound. It was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Right? The people knew that Nero had been killed, but yet he seems to be back. So why would John say that sort of thing? Why would this be a connection with Nero? Because Nero is definitely dead. Or is he? I'll come to this in just a minute, but in addition to this... this public, condemnation of memory, right? They scrubbed his face from all sorts of things. They took statues of him, and they redid the face on it. They buried his palace. They wanted to erase his memory. They had a funeral that was not public. And so a lot of people thought, hey, maybe Nero didn't actually die. Maybe he's just run off. Maybe he's coming back. It's what's called the Nero Redivivus myth. Now, can we think of someone else who has died and yet came back from the dead? Yes. In the first century, though. All right, so I'll come back to that in just a minute, why that matters. Not only that, but why is he associating this with Babylon? He talks about the seven heads, or seven hills, but they're also seven kings. Right? These are the seven hills of Rome. Rome is known to be found on seven hills. That's not a question, okay? And that's why, as well, in the Reformation, that John Calvin and Martin Luther, and then before that, Jan Hus, will make connections with the Roman Church, okay, as being the Antichrist. But let's set that aside for now. So that this Roman power is particularly associated with 666, that one in particular is the worst that it gets for the church, because he then kills people who belong to the church. And I think I have a text that will... Oh, come on. You know, technology is supposed to be helpful. I don't want you to stop. There we go. Okay. Here was the fear of the first century world. For those who were on the border of the Roman Empire, right, the people in the borders were always terrified of the neighbors on the outside, the Goths, the Visigoths, and so on, because they were the border territory, and they were always at risk of being attacked. And you have one really major powerful empire on the outskirts. It's called the Parthian Empire. It's what's left of the Persian Empire at this point in time. And like I said, remember, the angels are at the border of the Euphrates, and it talks about these horsemen coming over. The Parthians were known for their cavalry and for their riders who rode on horseback using bows. So that's why sometimes people say that the white horse might be a reference to the Parthian Empire, because of these their highly feared cavalry. Now, every emperor up to the point of Nero had not been on good terms with the Parthian Empire. But Nero, not only was he on Is this on? There you go. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Not only was Nero on good terms with the emperor, but he coronated their most recent emperor. And so he had completely positive associations with this empire. No, you know, sort of like a treaty, an armistice. Look, we won't attack you, you don't attack us. Now, if you have an emperor who's angry, who has not died but faked his death and maybe disappeared, where is he going to go? He's going to go where he has friends. And so there's a very real fear around this time that, for some people, that Nero has gotten away and he's gone to the Parthian Empire. And he's going to bring back the army and destroy Rome. Okay? And so this makes a lot of sense of these fears that John is playing on in Revelation. Not only that, how do we know this happened? A guy named Suetonius, Dio Chrysostom, and the Sibylline oracles all refer to this myth. They all talk about Nero didn't actually die, but he's actually coming back. And so these are all first through third century texts. All first. Suetonius and Sibylline oracles, anyway. And pretenders show up in 69, 80, and 88. So this is just 2 years after Nero has died. And how do they show up and say, well, by the way, I'm Nero. It's me. How do you think they pulled that off? It's actually pretty simple. They looked like him. And in fact, this last one came back with part of the Parthian army. And so you have a very real fear that John is talking about once again. Now, John doesn't seem to believe that Nero has actually been raised from the dead, or that he has faked his death, but he's taking like these sorts of things that are common within this culture at this time, this fear, and he's saying, yes, this sort of thing is always happening with the empire. This is not new. This is old, and it will happen again and again. The emperor who will come back, this emperor who will disappear, this emperor, that he's the perfect anti-Christ type figure without that word actually being in Revelation. He's the perfect sort of figure. He persecutes the church. People think he's died and coming back. But also, it didn't actually happen as opposed to Christ, as opposed to the actual victory that happened to the Lamb. And not only does he come back, but he comes back with violence and conquering, but not conquering by his word that brings people to worshiping the true God. I mean, you can't get a better figure, I think, in history. Well, okay, maybe Hitler or Stalin, that is more of an anti-Christ type figure, that figures better into God's kingdom versus the empire that repeats itself throughout history. You gonna work for me? No. Not only that, but he mentions this strange text there, the seven kings. The beast was one and is not. It's an eighth, and it's one of the seven. It's this weird sort of reference, but he's talking about he wants to bring Nero back into the discussion, but also talk about these seven hills and bring it back to that sort of discussion, this emphasis on it being Rome rather than being just Nero. Yeah. The gobbledygook? People language. Oh, you want these to show what these are connected to? Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so again, what John is doing, he's taking that number seven, which is number for completeness. And so this is the completeness of the evil of the empire. This is why I avoid language of perfection, because it makes it sound like this is the perfect empire. There's not a perfect empire. It's bad. Empire is bad, but this is the complete empire. That is, that it's represented with seven heads because it's the fullness of evil manifested in the ongoing pattern of empire. So he's not saying there's just going to be seven kings. He's not saying that it's only Rome, that those seven hills, but he's saying that these are examples of very real evil power, and that it will continue to show up in the same pattern that we've seen with Babylon or Rome. He also refers to Egypt and Jerusalem in the text. So his point is just this, that this is going to be a pattern that we see its fullness in well, in this example of a beast. And so it's going to keep fighting God's kingdom until God's kingdom is in its complete fullness, we see in Revelation 20, 21, and 22. So most of this is not about the future, except in a pattern that keeps repeating that we'll keep seeing, empires pop up and treating people in a way, Christians especially, in a way that destroys them, that causes them to cry out from under the altar, God, how long until our brothers will join us? And that God will continue calling out his people who belong to 144,000, which is a significantly large number, but not exactly how many people will be saved. Does that make sense? Or do you want to ask a further question? Okay. Like I said, the important thing about 144,000, against the way that it's read in the Jehovah's Witness tradition, is that he makes it clear that it's not just 144,000, but it's a significantly large number that he hears, because after he hears it, he turns around and says, a great multitude that no one could number, but they just numbered them. And so the point is that he's declaring a large number. That's a square of a significant number, 12. And then this one, I don't know why I actually included this on the end. They were make her desolate and naked. Oh, the self-destructive power of the empire. That not only will it raise up and look beautiful and seem incredible, but that it will also inevitably destroy itself. And so when we read about God's judgments are poured out in a way like Romans 1. He just gave them over to themselves. And they fall apart. They combust internally. Okay? And that's precisely what happens in Rome. They get too big. They can't take care of themselves. And then finally the Visigoths show up and destroy them. And then the Byzantine Empire takes over. And then we have the same problem with the Byzantine Empire, because you have the question of who's got the power here? The religion, the religious power of the church, or the state. And only one of those can win out. And so we have the state sort of co-opting religious ideas and religious practices and saying and doing the same sort of thing. Everything the state does is sacred. Yes?
This is your tent.
Oh, yeah, the ten horns.
Ten horns.
Yeah. Ten horns that you saw. I think this is just connected with Daniel, but I'm not sure why. I haven't paid attention to ten. Yeah, crowns, diadems, that sort of stuff, yeah. That's a good question. I'll look at it, and then I'll maybe come back with something next week. That's okay. Any questions about any or all of this? Does that help make sense of what John is trying to do? I think so. This has been, you know, when I read some of the stuff that, you know, I grew up in a church that a certain reading was really common, at least in our youth group, of sort of a dispensationalist take on things and reading the seven churches as seven periods of time. And I thought that was just the way the church had always read it. And then after I was just scared of Revelation, so I didn't do anything with Revelation until later in seminary, and I realized that I felt like the way I had been taught was a little bit of an escapist approach to it was so different from the way that Paul talks about being a Christian, and that enduring and persecution, that endurance and persecution mark you out as belonging to the kingdom of God, and that the early church clearly identified with. We have books by people like Justin Martyr, who goes to be executed gladly, willingly, because he says this identifies, I'm filling up the sufferings of Christ in my body. Not that Jesus' sacrifice wasn't finished, but that belonging to the body of Christ means that we continue to suffer, and that we could keep on filling up those sufferings until the end of time. So that made more sense to me. And then I started asking questions about this and found out that the approach that I'd learned, dispensationalism, was only about 200 years old, and that most of the church hadn't thought of it in those terms for most of its time. So spending time reading and asking more questions, and then situating it in the first century and seeing the way that people would have understood numbers. And again, I think the most important thing is remembering that it meant something to the first century church. They would have gotten this and said, ah, we are terrible. In Laodicea, anyway. We're just terrible. And other churches saying, okay, we're doing the right thing. Remember, see the world the right way. The victory of the Lamb, God on the throne, and that we participate in that, right? That we share in that. that if we have died with Christ, we have been raised with him, and we are seated with him, right? That's the great thing in Ephesians. We are seated with Christ. There's something about us that Christ takes with him and places us in the presence of God. And that they're being reminded of that here in this text. And it's an encouragement. Don't give up. That suffering is part of being a Christian. Don't compromise, because if you do, you have made a choice. You belong to the prostitute and the beast, and you'll be destroyed with them. So eventually we have this language of come out of Babylon. But that made the most sense. Having read it in this light and reading these other texts that are the same sort of genre makes the most sense to me. Okay, it's not like reading a history book. It's very different. It's not like reading a textbook either. It's not like reading a spam email. It's just a different genre that we need the right tools. Right? I think one of the helpful things as well is knowing that certain tools can help us do things. Right, I can open a package with a screwdriver, but it might be easier to use a knife. And screwdrivers are good for screwing in screws, and that's the sort of tool they're designed for, or the sort of thing they're designed for. And so realizing what tools we have, first century archaeological stuff, first century texts that help us read Revelation a little bit better. And I think that's been what's been most helpful for me over the last 6 or 7 years with Revelation. Okay. Let me think. Two books that I found were really helpful. Three. With Revelation. I'm hesitant to use the internet for Revelation because there's so much crazy stuff out there. I mean, really, really crazy stuff. I go to New Testament scholars whom I trust. One that you can actually that I rely on, a good friend of mine who's been the head of the Revelation, what's it called, the Revelation reading group for the society, British New Testament Society, is a guy named Ian Paul, and he's got a website, a blog, where he writes on this stuff. Say, fidzo.com, right? It's I calculate. So anyway, he talks about Revelation. He talks about lots of other things. He can at times be controversial because he gets into a number of other issues. But if you're wondering about books on Revelation, he was the head of the reading group for the better part of 10 years, and now he's just written a commentary on Revelation, and his dissertation was on Revelation. So I trust him. His name is Ian Paul. Although I've been told you can't trust a guy with two first names. But I do trust him. So that's an online resource that you can search. Just search for Revelation. He talks about it a lot, and it's a good resource. A good book that deals with how do we worship with Revelation is one by Eugene Peterson, the guy who did The Message. And it's called Reverse Thunder. He's wrong about some things, but that's okay. Like I told you, I think that he talks about the white horses being the Parthian horsemen, but I'm still set that this is a representation of Apollo because it's associated with the emperor. Right? There's nothing better about, like when you get to the point about you've got the horsemen, then you get to these demonic hordes, that it's saying that your emperor operates by the power of hell and Satan. I mean, that's a pretty strong condemnation. If you're looking to get executed, then he's done a good job. Yeah. Reverse Thunder. Let me think. A bit more difficult book, but still really rewarding, and you can get it on Kindle, is by a guy named Richard Bauckham. His book is called Theology of the Book of Revelation. He's harder to read. He also wrote a book called Climax of Prophecy, and it's deep. It takes a lot to get through. He's read everything, and he remembers everything. He's one of those guys who's just like, man, I don't like you. He remembers everything. You know, he's got so much. He's just an excellent scholar. So, Bauckham. There's one that's a bit more, I think, political, but it's what I essentially named the course after. He ends up going in certain directions that can politically, I think, that can make people uncomfortable or angry. But overall, I think that his book is really helpful for giving you a perspective on Revelation. And his name is Michael Gorman. And it's called Reading Revelation Responsibly. Ian Paul also wrote a little booklet called How to Read Revelation. It's what's called this series called Grove Books Booklets. And you can get it, you can also get a Kindle version of that. Those are my recommendations. For commentaries, if you're interested in commentaries are just boring to read is the problem. It's only if you have some real interest in research, then I could talk about those another time. But those are, I think, the four best resources for situating it historically and understanding what John's message is overall, that it's an ongoing message to the church in all of its different reactions to or involvement in the empire. All right. I finished just 1 minute after 11:30. Any questions, or can we hold on till next week? Okay, thanks.